Hi, it's Michael Senoff with HardToFindSeminars.com. The title of this interview is called The Surprising Way Your Brain Reacts to Depression and the New Developments That Can Bring It Back. Dr. Michael Banov, psychologist and author of Taking Antidepressants, has been studying depression for years, but he says it's only been recently that scientists have discovered what happens to your brain during times of depression. Because it doesn't produce enough of the brain chemicals it needs to thrive, it actually shrinks. The good news, it's not a permanent condition. After successful treatment, the brain will grow back, but Dr. Banov says treatment isn't as simple as popping a few pills and declaring yourself cured. Depression is a whole body illness and requires a whole body intervention. And in this audio interview, you'll hear all about the latest developments in the areas of depression and all the latest treatments. You'll also hear a quick test that will let you know if what you're feeling is normal sadness or clinical depression. You'll also hear a little known fact. Treatment should always be partnership between you and your doctor, and a quick checklist of what to look for in a doctor to make sure you find one responsive to your needs. You'll hear about the big distinction between depression and bipolar disorder and the absolute critical reason bipolar patients need to make sure they're not prescribed antidepressants by mistake. You'll hear five sneaky illnesses that mimic the signs of depression so you can rule out the physical before you seek treatment for depression. You'll hear exactly how antidepressants work with the body, the common side effects you can expect, and the important steps you need to take if you want to switch drugs. And you'll hear about the only proven holistic treatment that actually works to treat depression and how to take them. Dr. Banov says the longer you wait to treat your depression, the harder it is to treat. So it's especially important to get the ball rolling as soon as possible if you think you or someone you love may be suffering from it. And in this audio, you'll hear everything you need to know to get the ball rolling today. Now let's get going.
Hi, this is Chris Costello, and I've teamed up with Michael Senoff to bring you the world's best health-related interviews. So if you know anyone struggling with their weight, with cancer, diabetes, ADHD, autism, heart disease, or other health issues, send them over to Michael Senoff's HardToFindSeminars.com. And today we are talking with Dr. Michael Banov. And he has written a new book called Taking Antidepressants, Your Comprehensive Guide to Starting, Staying On, and Safely Quitting. Dr. Banov, thank you so much for being with us today.
Well, thanks for having me.
So this really is a comprehensive book, and I'd like to kind of just start out with that. Let's define depression, if we can, a little bit.
That's a harder question than you might realize. And unfortunately, unlike other medical diseases or illnesses where you can point to something on a chest x-ray or a blood test or a brain scan and say, here it is, we can't do that with depression. And it's normal for people to feel sad or down or stressed out or anxious when bad or stressful things happen in their life. But that's a very different experience than someone who's going through what we call capital D depression, you know, real clinical type depression. And there's a lot of evidence that that type of depression affects the brain and the body in such a way that physical changes occur that make it very difficult for people going through that to function on a day-to-day basis. So one of the differences between just being normally sad or down versus having clinical depression is you can't do the things you need to do to make yourself feel better. And that's where it's really important at that point to get some professional advice on how to get yourself feeling better.
And so what are some of the symptoms that people can look for with depression if they suspect they might be suffering from it?
Well, there's the technical symptoms of depression, and I'll kind of explain why I'm sort of qualifying that in a minute or two. But the technical symptoms of depression, if you go look up in a medical textbook or go online, are there's nine what we call sort of criteria, and you have to have five out of the nine to meet the criteria for depression. And those include things like sleep, energy, appetite changes, trouble concentrating, difficulty with motivation, feeling down on yourself, and even in some situations can even involve having thoughts of not wanting to go on, not wanting to live, or having suicidal types of thoughts. Now, people can have depression, and doctors and therapists will often diagnose depression even when people don't have five out of the nine, or if they have other symptoms that aren't on that sort of official checklist, things like irritability, for chronic pain, such as muscle aches and pain and other types of physical symptoms. Obsessive or compulsive ruminations can all be signs of depression, too. So I don't want everybody to think that just if you have to have those specific criteria, that we think the definition broadens a little bit. And it's important to realize that because you may not be experiencing what other people who are experiencing depression are going through, or what you might read about on the internet or in books or hear from healthcare professionals.
And Dr. Banoff, how do you sort out people, I'm sure, come to you with just kind of the typical aches and pains and that kind of thing? How do you sort out physical illness versus a diagnosis of depression?
Well, I think it's really important, if you've never been diagnosed before, you've never had any treatment before, to see a medical physician first who's familiar and comfortable with depression and can rule out some of the physical causes. Because there are some doctors who are very good primary care physicians or internal medicine or family doctors, but don't know a whole lot about depression. They may not know the kinds of things that you want to look for to rule out. But there's a lot of physical symptoms that can mimic depression. And it's not that uncommon to have somebody present with classic symptoms of depression and have a low thyroid or low vitamin D levels, or have anemia, low blood count, sometimes various health problems like heart problems, diabetes, blood pressure changes, parathyroid problems. I mean, the list goes on, and I talk a lot about those in the book, too. And most of these can be ruled out through simple lab tests. So the nice thing is, if you go to a doctor with complaints consistent with depression, things like low energy, fatigue, low motivation, difficulty sleeping, not feeling rested, trouble concentrating, sometimes a simple physical exam and a straightforward battery of lab tests will rule out most physical conditions. But it's important. And the other thing is, many people sometimes will have a combination of both. They may have depression, but they may also have a physical problem that could be making the depression worse or more difficult to treat. And it's not uncommon in my practice to have people come to see me who are on an antidepressant and doing a little better, or seeing a therapist and doing a little better, but really not as good as they should be. And we find out that maybe they had a thyroid problem. And once we treat that, then all of a sudden their depression gets much better. But it's not as though they didn't have depression in the first place, and they still might need to take the antidepressant or continue whatever other type of treatment they're using to help their depression get better.
And so in taking antidepressants, you also talk about the brain, and I'd like to talk a little bit about that and explain to people what's actually going on in the brain with depression. What do we know?
Well, there's a lot of little pieces to the puzzle that we know, but the problem is we don't know how all the pieces fit together in the big picture. And I'll tell you a few of the things that we know for sure, and these may be terms that people have heard over the years. One thing we know happens when people get depressed or are very genetically predisposed to depression is they may have different levels of chemicals in the brain called neurotransmitters. And what neurotransmitters are they're little chemicals that we produce that help the brain talk to itself. When one neuron wants to send another neuron a message, it shoots a little chemical across. And the most common ones that people have heard of that are associated with depression, mood, and anxiety are things like serotonin and norepinephrine and dopamine. And they're all somewhat related chemicals. And we found that in people with depression and anxiety and other mood problems, that those levels of those chemicals might be quite low. And that's what we've been basing a lot of our research on and medical treatments on for many years is that. But now there's a whole new array of discoveries going on that are fascinating and very relevant. And that's in an area called neurotrophic factors, kind of a complicated word, but what it basically is brain food, that your brain produces certain chemicals, and one of the most common ones is one called BDNF, or brain-derived neurotrophic factor. And this is something that your brain produces, and it makes the brain function better. It makes new neurons work more efficiently and grow and become more robust. So like I said, it's sort of like a brain food. And we found in people under a lot of stress or people in chronic pain, people with very severe medical problems, and in depression, these levels of this BDNF are quite low. And what it does is it actually can cause parts of your brain to start to shrink a little bit. And when you tell people who have depression, you know, parts of your brain are shrinking, it's a really scary thing. The great news about that is that when you get treated, the brain goes back to where it was before. It's not a permanent type of injury. It's not like people tend to think of if you have a stroke or you sever a spinal cord, you know, new neurons don't regrow and reform. But we know that in some areas of the brain, particularly when it comes to mood and anxiety, that it does. And this may explain why many people with depression have trouble with concentration and focus. And even when they feel better, their moods get better, sometimes the concentration tends to lag quite a bit because they'll feel better, they'll go back to work, but they're just not quite as sharp as they used to be. And that can sometimes take 3 or 6 months after your depression has gotten better, and that may relate to the BDNF or brain neurotrophic factors. So there's a lot of fascinating areas, and these all have relevance towards treatment. And some of the new medicines, and I do a lot of clinical research, are geared towards looking at these other chemicals in the brain to repair those. But also it's very important, since I said that things like chronic pain or medical illnesses and stress also can affect these chemicals too, it's important to address those as well. So people who are under a lot of stress need to make lifestyle changes to reduce the stress in their life. If they're in chronic pain, they need to do whatever they can do to help themselves get out of chronic pain or manage their medical conditions better, and that will all help people feel better as well. It's not just, can I take a pill to restore the BDNF? There are a lot of other things you need to do, and you need to think about depression as a whole body illness, and to get better, you have to do a whole body intervention to get back to where you need to be.
For more interviews on health, mind, body, and spirit, go to Michael Senoff's hardtofindseminars.com. So, Dr. Vanoff, it sounds like when you're talking about things like brain shrinkage being involved in depression, it's definitely something that people need to treat. And whether it's holistically, which many people prefer to go that route, or with pharmaceuticals, it sounds like it's something you really need to get help with, not something you should try to do on your own.
Absolutely. And, you know, one of the reasons I wrote this book is I'm a practicing psychiatrist, so I see patients every day, and everybody comes up with the same questions over and over again. And they tend to go online or they get a book from the bookstore or something about depression. And what many people see are books with an agenda. They may be very anti-medicine or anti-depression or pushing one thing or another. And what my book tries to do is present the entire landscape. I'm not advocating medicine, but I'm not discouraging or negative about medicines, too. I think there are risks to medicines, and it certainly wouldn't be something, although there are some cases where you'd want to do it as a first line. But most of the time, I'm a strong advocate of trying other things to get better first before you get on medicine. But it is very important, no matter what, to get help and to get treatment and know what all your treatment options are out there. Because there are a lot of things you can do. And you made a very important reference there about getting help. Because what we found is the longer you wait to get treatment, the harder it is to get treated. It's no different than if you have a pneumonia or if you have cancer or any other medical condition. Delaying treatment can make the treatment much, much harder. And we have evidence to show that the longer you go without getting well, the more likely it is for your depression to come back over and over again, the more likely you are to have some of those trouble with focusing and concentration. And people who desperately want to avoid getting on antidepressants will find sometimes they end up on more medicine than they wanted to because they waited too long to get help. But the most important thing is that if you think you may be dealing with depression or you know somebody may be dealing with it, to get help immediately. And don't just assume that you need to get on the medicine. A lot of people don't want to see a doctor because they assume they're going to walk out the door with a prescription and they don't want to take anything. And what I talk about in the book, although the book doesn't focus specifically only on non-medication treatments, I do make references to many that are out there that are proven. I mean, these aren't things that I thought of in the middle of the night or some kind of hocus-pocus stuff that somebody came up with. These are interventions that have undergone scientific scrutiny and show that they really help, when applied, really help people with depression.
And so really your book is much more than just about taking antidepressants. And so you mentioned that you've seen hundreds and thousands of patients. What I'd like to hear, you know, what should a good appointment, your first appointment with a medical professional look like?
And in my book, I talk a lot about that. In the back of the book, I have a list of information that will make it very helpful for the doctor to make a good assessment for you. So the number one thing you need to do is make sure you're seeing somebody who is comfortable diagnosing, treating depression, and someone that can give you all your treatment alternatives. You want to make sure that you're seeing somebody who can make sure that you get the appropriate physical workup to rule out any other medical or physical problems. And I think one of the most important things when you're seeing a doctor for that first visit is to make it very clear to the doctor what you would like to do as far as your depression goes. Because sometimes people will come into my office and they'll have all kinds of mood and anxiety problems. And they'll say, well, did you have any ideas of what you think you might do to get better? And they might say, I'll do whatever it takes, but I don't want to get on medicine. Or they might say, I'll do whatever it takes, but I do not want to see a therapist. Or I'll do whatever I take, but I don't want to stop taking out on pizza and beer. Now, I may not agree with what they're saying, but I have to be respectful of that. And I have to say, well, look, we can try it your way, and here's what my recommendations would be. And I think that if the doctor takes that approach, that I think that eventually either the person will get better because they're motivated. If they say, look, you tell me what to do, anything but medicine. If I tell them to exercise, change their diet, and go to counseling, they do all that, they have a good chance that they may get better. And if they don't, I think they're more likely to engage in the other recommendation than if I didn't have a better sense of where they were at. And I think one of the biggest reasons people don't follow up with treatment is either, one, they think that the doctor came to a decision too quickly. You know, I walked in there for 5 minutes and I left with a prescription. And that doesn't inspire a lot of confidence, I think, to some patients. And I think they're less likely to take the medicine. Or two, just feeling like the doctor really didn't hear what they wanted to do and not having enough confidence in their recommendation. So I really feel like that's very important, that it should be a partnership between the doctor and the patient, and to make sure that you're seeing somebody that you feel like you're part of the treatment decision with. And so the doctor's checking you out, but you need to check the doctor out too and just make sure you're on the same page. And don't expect that the doctor's going to have some magic solution for you, that you're going to feel better in 1 week. It probably took you a while to get to where you were at. And it's going to take a while to get out of depression if you do it the right way. You know, I know we live in America where everybody wants their hamburger in 20 seconds or less, but it just doesn't happen that quickly. And real treatment takes a little while, but the real treatment is effective and will last.
And how long do you think an office visit needs to be, really, to get to some of these solutions for people with depression?
Well, you know, that's a tough question about how long should an office visit be, because a lot of it depends on the kind of information that you're comfortable sharing, how long it takes to establish a relationship. You know, I've done some initial evaluations that take 30 minutes, and some take an hour and 30 minutes. And sometimes people come in with so much and such a complicated history that at the end of, you know, normally I'll schedule people for about an hour for the first time. And that's what most psychiatrists will do. Family doctors probably won't spend that much time, at least particularly just focused on a mental health issue or problem. But sometimes after that hour, I go, you know, there's so much here, we're just going to have to get together again in a week or two and fill in some of the gaps here. But everybody's different, and I hate for it to sort of be time-based. It's really what the person needs specifically. And unfortunately, with the way insurance works and managed care and all that, we find that there's a phenomenon now where doctors and therapists kind of double-team people, that you might see a doctor who's managing more the medical part of the depression and the medicines, and then sometimes a therapist like a PhD psychologist, a social worker, another master's level therapist like a licensed professional counselor or pastoral counselor or something like that, who's doing more of the therapy piece. And that's sort of a phenomenon in the last 10 or 15 years with all the insurance changes and things like that. And there's some advantages and disadvantages to that model, but either way, that's kind of the model that many practices use these days.
So it's very individual, it sounds like.
Yeah, I think it really should be. It should be tailor-made. And some people bring a lot more to the table than others. I have people that come to see me that have had depression off and on throughout much of their life. And they know that they take their Prozac and they do well and they may stop it and do fine for 5 or 10 years. And then depression comes back and they go back on their Prozac and they live happily ever after again. And so for that person, maybe an hour appointment or more really isn't necessary because it's very straightforward. One of the things I talk a lot about in the book is different types of depression. I think there's a tendency to think of depression as one thing, and it's not. The best analogy I can use to describe that is, let's say 100 years ago, you had chest pain and you went to the doctor and the doctor says, okay, you have a diagnosis of chest pain. Well, are you having a broken rib? Are you having a pneumonia? Are you having a heart attack? You have a pulled muscle? I mean, it could be totally different things causing the same symptom of chest pain. And that's true with depression today. Somebody comes into a doctor's office feeling sad or down, no energy, can't concentrate. It could be a very different thing going on with that person than someone else with the same symptom. And that's why if you have a friend or a family member or somebody else who's gone through depression and they got on the magic drug X or saw the magic therapist and got so much better, you can't necessarily base your treatment on that because they may have something going on completely different than what you have going on.
So does depression run in families?
Well, the short answer is yes. And there's probably two reasons. If you have a depressed parent, it's very likely that you are probably going to grow up with a lot of stress and complications from having a depressed parent. But we know also, particularly from adoption studies, that there are depression genes. Now, it's not a single gene. It's not like inheriting brown hair or blue eyes where you're either going to get it or you're not. What you do is you inherit a vulnerability. It's sort of a combination of different genes. And we've identified some of them, but not enough that you can come into my office and I can draw some blood and do a genetic analysis and say either you have depression or you're going to get depression. So you inherit a vulnerability. And we think that depression is some kind of magic formula of a certain amount of stress and a certain amount of genes. So if you have lots of gene depressions, you may only need a little stress. And I have people come into my office all the time. They don't seem to have a care in the world. They've got money. They've got a supportive spouse, wonderful family life, meaningful work. But they're horribly depressed because they're so genetically loaded for depression. Mm. And then other people who come into my office who've gone through catastrophic life events and you hear their life and you go, how are you even standing? You know, and it takes that much. So for those people, they may have very little genetic predisposition, but just a whole lot of stress to kick it in.
You're listening to an interview on Michael Senoff's HardToFindSeminars.com. That must take great strength of character to not make judgments on the whole depression thing there.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, sometimes people will get comments, I'll hear it, or my patients will hear, well, gee, you have nothing to be depressed about. You know, look at your life. You have this and that, and I've got nothing, or I've been through this adversity. And I have to try to educate people that that's not what depression is about. You know, it's not that if so much happens to you, then you therefore deserve to be depressed. It's like, you know, some people are genetically loaded for diabetes and some people aren't. So one person goes and has two scoops of ice cream and their blood sugar goes to the roof. Another person gets four scoops of ice cream and three chocolate cakes and their blood sugar is fine.
Right,
it's just
right.
The way that their bodies were made, and it's not that the person with the two scoops deserved, you know, or doesn't deserve to have the diabetes.
And now in taking antidepressants, Dr. Vanoff, you also talk about some common psychiatric disorders that can often co-occur with depression. What are some of those things?
Well, very often we do see combinations of illnesses, and these things unfortunately sort of put people at risk for other ones. Well, one thing we always want to make sure we're not dealing with when someone comes in with depression is making sure they don't have what we call bipolar disorder or manic depression. Some people will come into the doctor's office and they may feel very down or blue, but they may have had a history in the past of having periods where they felt almost too good or almost high, euphoric, maybe went days or weeks without sleeping and were up all night and doing things and productive. Maybe people thought they were on some drugs or something like that. And it's important to differentiate the two because you don't want to give somebody who has bipolar disorder, even if they have depression, you don't want to give them an antidepressant as a first-line treatment. They often need something else called a mood stabilizer. So that's a very important differential we need to make, even though the depression from bipolar depression can look exactly the same as just a regular depression, or what we call unipolar depression. there are a lot of anxiety disorders that can co-occur with depression. Panic attacks or panic disorder is one. Obsessive compulsive disorder. Many people with depression have had some traumas in their life and may suffer from what we call post-traumatic stress disorder. So these are all very common. But the one that we get very concerned about as well is substance abuse, that many people use drugs or alcohol to excess to the point that it either triggers the depression or they use the drugs or alcohol to treat depression. But if alcohol is from the depression or the cause of the depression, either way, it becomes a major obstacle to getting better, and it's really important to get that addressed because it's very unlikely you're going to get better with an antidepressant or anything you use unless you stop using the drugs or alcohol.
So it almost sounds like you have to treat the alcohol or drug addiction first. Is that right?
Yes. Now, what will happen is people come to see me, and they go, well, you know, doctor, if I wasn't so depressed, I'd stop drinking, or I wouldn't use the drugs. And they want to have me give them something like, say, an antidepressant that makes them feel better, and they think they're just going to magically stop using, and it doesn't work like that. Mm-hmm. That whether it was the cause or not, the fact is once you have substance abuse, it needs to be treated as substance abuse, and they need to be treated simultaneously. And that's a hard thing to hear because it takes a lot of work. It's not easy to get off alcohol and drugs if it's become a big part of your life, but it is very important, and you will sabotage your ability to get better if you don't get help for it.
Right, and I would imagine that on top of the physical neurobiological symptoms of a depressed brain, to add the addictive brain in there too must be really something to try to treat.
Yes, I tell people it's like trying to put out a fire with gasoline.
Right.
Real bad idea.
Yeah. Now, what are some of the symptoms of bipolar disorder? It sounds like it's pretty important to know the difference between depression and bipolar.
Yes, I mentioned a few earlier. That would be if you've ever had any symptoms with mania, and mania, like I said before, is being almost euphoric, feeling top of the world, I can do anything. Some people might have episodes like that last a few hours or a half a day. But I'm talking about when you get that lasts for many several days or a couple weeks or even sometimes months, and they'll do very reckless and impulsive things. They go spend money they don't have or go gambling or sometimes sexual indiscretions or things like that, very impulsive. That's sort of the easy to recognize symptoms of mania. There's a little more of a challenging type of mania, which we call either mixed or dysphoric mania, that's not so clear cut. And that's people may experience being very irritable, temperamental. They still may be impulsive, but angry, can't sleep, feel depressed, racing thoughts. And sometimes very difficult for even a healthcare professional to know if that's depression or a mixed dysphoric mania. And the reason, as I mentioned earlier, it's important to differentiate is if you think it's depression and that person gets on an antidepressant, they can actually feel worse. And it could be a very bad outcome. So trying to differentiate that's very important. The other challenge is that somebody can have as their first episode of a mood problem being depression and get treated for that, but then a manic episode occurs a year later or 2 years later. Well, they didn't turn into having a bipolar illness. They always had it. They just got the depression first and the mania didn't show up later. So even a good doctor may miss the diagnosis because there was no real clue that they had any history of mania because it hadn't really occurred yet. So those are things you have to be careful about before you start medication, just to make sure that none of that's evident. Because what we don't want to do is certainly just make anything worse. You know, the Hippocratic Oath says, above all, do no harm. And that's another good reason that if you can avoid taking antidepressants and get your depression under control without medicine, by all means, I think it's a great idea because that is one of the potential downsides to taking antidepressants.
And now, one of the things in taking antidepressants, you've got a quote in there that says in a study, only 50% of those who had depression were getting any treatment?
Well, yes, unfortunately, we still live in a society where there's a huge stigma, a lot of misunderstanding about depression, and people are very reluctant to get help for a number of reasons. One is they're embarrassed to get help, embarrassed to say that they have this problem, and we still carry a stigma of, well, depression somehow is your fault, or you're weak-willed, or you haven't been pulling yourself up by your bootstraps, and all those sort of expressions. So there is a tendency for that. The other thing is sometimes people will go get help. They might get on a medicine. They may take the medicine for a week or two, either not feel any better if they didn't give it the whole 4 to 6 weeks that it's needed, or maybe they had some uncomfortable side effect, and they just said, you know, I'm not going to take this. And fortunately, we have a lot of medications out there. So if you do get a side effect that you don't like, but it's very discomforting, there are a lot of other alternatives. And most people, unfortunately not everybody, but most people can find a medicine with either no or very, very few side effects that's tolerable. Well, one thing that we talked about before we started the interview that a third of the book is dedicated to is about coming off of antidepressants.
Oh, yes, but let me roll back a little bit because I do want to ask you one question, and then I also want to start with explaining about the medications before we talk about getting off.
Sure.
Okay. And so, Dr. Banoff, what percentage of the U.S. population is suffering from depression or bipolar, that kind of thing? Do you have a sense of that?
Well, there's lots of different estimates, and there are some estimates that rate as high as 20 to 25% of the population will suffer from depression at some point in their life. Now, that doesn't mean that all 20 to 25% need to go on medicines, but there is that risk of people going through depression that high. Bipolar disorder is probably estimated at about 5% of the population. So they're highly prevalent, and the impact of depression on one's physical health and their functioning is as high as things like diabetes and high blood pressure and all these other very serious medical problems as well. But it's not a minor thing to have depression. It can have a tremendous impact on your life.
For more interviews on health, mind, body, and spirit, go to Michael Senoff's hardtofindseminars.com. And your family, I would imagine, also.
Absolutely.
And with children, are the symptoms different? How do you recognize depression in children?
Yes, that's a very complicated area. I actually have a chapter dedicated to diagnosing and treating depression in kids. Kids fall into a very different area because a lot of the conventional tools for diagnosing and symptoms don't happen in kids. They tend to have more behavior problems, more behavioral outbursts, anger, irritability, problems in school. They don't tend to sort of say, I feel sad or down. It's more the acting out. And one of the complications with kids, particularly when it comes to antidepressants, is that there's a small number but significant number of kids who, when they take antidepressants, actually can feel worse. And in some of the studies showed that some of them will get an increase in suicidal thoughts. Now, that doesn't mean by any means all. It's a very small percentage, but it's a very severe problem if it occurs. So it's very important if you start anybody, actually anywhere below the age of 25, that you have to monitor very, very carefully and educate the individual and the family that if they start to feel worse, they need to call their doctor immediately and let them know. And also with kids, it's very hard to accurately diagnose. So somebody comes in with behavior problems, you don't know if their family issues causing it, or attention deficit disorder, or bipolar, or all these other things. So doing the differential we talked about earlier is much more complicated with kids, and the response to medicines is much less predictable than it is in adults.
It's almost a whole other field, it sounds like.
It is. It's very difficult, and you really have to go see a specialist. I don't advise families to take their kids to, say, their pediatrician, unless the pediatrician really specializes in mood and anxiety problems. It's a whole specialty area that I think really needs to see a true expert in the area.
So, Dr. Banoff, in taking antidepressants, you've also got an interesting quote. 25% of the people who are prescribed antidepressants don't fill the prescription or stop taking them after 2 weeks. So I'd like to ask you, you've got a lot of information about the different medications for depression and also natural remedies and therapies. So let's talk about that a little.
I think one of the reasons, and I've touched on some of these already, the reasons people get the prescription, either don't fill it or only take it for a couple weeks. Maybe they feel like their doctor went a little too quickly to give them the medicine. Maybe they have concerns, something they read on the internet or heard from somebody about the medicine, and maybe didn't feel comfortable asking their doctor about it, so they opted not to do it. Another common reason that people only take it for a couple weeks is that most of the side effects you get from antidepressants you tend to get up front. The common ones are maybe stomach upset, or a little diarrhea, or constipation, or headaches, or sleepy, or feeling jittery. And fortunately, most of these will go away if you stay on the medicine a while. But somebody takes the medicine and feels that way for a week or two and goes, well, gee, I don't want to feel like this for the next 6 or 9 months, so I'm not going to continue it. Or they have an unrealistic expectation of how quickly they're going to work. Oh, I took it for a week, it didn't help me, so I stopped. not really realizing they need to be on it for 4 to 6 weeks.
And there's obviously a huge amount of medications available out there. Is that right?
There's over 30 commonly prescribed antidepressants. Many of them fit into the same general category. So let's say you tried Prozac and Zoloft and had a terrible reaction or they didn't work. I probably wouldn't go to, say, Paxil, which is kind of in that same family. Maybe try a different family that works on a little bit of the different chemicals in the brain. And so sometimes people will take a medicine and it'll keep them up. So try a medicine that's a little more sedating. So there are a lot of options out there. Now, what I can't say is I can't say that one antidepressant is better than another. It's only what works best for you. And a common question I get from people is, well, I just want to take the best one out there. And what I have to say is there's no such thing as the best one. It's whatever works best for you and gives you hopefully no or the fewest side effects possible.
And I'm sure they all have different mechanisms and ways that they work, but commonly, how do these medications improve a situation with depression?
Well, what they do is most of the ones on the market today affect those chemicals we talked about earlier, the serotonin, the norepinephrine, the dopamine. Many of them work by helping the body to use those chemicals more effectively and more efficiently. You may have heard the term serotonin reuptake inhibitor, or SSRI. That's what Prozac, Paxil, and Zoloft. Those are some of the more common antidepressants. And what they do is they block the breaking down of those chemicals. They block the reuptake. So they keep the chemicals in there longer, and they make the brain use them more efficiently. And eventually, your brain starts to make more of them and use them the way they're supposed to. And most all the antidepressants on the market tweak those neurotransmitters one way or the other. But we do have a lot of new medications in the pipeline. They're not available yet today. They're going to work on different areas of the brain that may give us better results and may even be safer and better tolerated medicine.
And you mentioned the brain shrinkage being present in people with depression. Do these medications restore the brain, basically, or how does that work?
Well, what we know is when you treat depression, the brain gets better. So you don't have to take an antidepressant in order to have that brain shrinkage improve. Sometimes depression can be so disabling that you do need to get on medicine, and that may be the only thing that kind of really helps. But in many situations, things like therapy, exercise, diet changes, some nutritional supplements, some of those, if taken properly, and if the person starts to feel better, that brain shrinkage will improve as well.
Right.
So the main thing is it's not necessarily what you do, but it's getting the help and getting your depression treated, which is what restores your brain back to where it was before.
And before we get into the holistic treatments, what are some of the risks with medication? I know there's people that are afraid of taking medication.
Well, we don't know of any, on the whole, very dangerous side effects from antidepressants. As a class, they're extremely safe. The one concerning area that we have, and I mentioned this earlier, is that some people, particularly younger people, when they take an antidepressant, can actually feel worse or get an increase in suicidal thoughts. This is very rare in people over the age of 25, but it can happen. So it's rare, but when it happens, it's quite serious. Or if you give someone who actually has manic depression an antidepressant, that can be dangerous. Some of the older antidepressants that aren't used much anymore, one group is called monoamine oxidase inhibitors, or MAOIs, or another class called tricyclics. If somebody took too many of them or overdosed on them or mixed other medicines with it, they could be very dangerous. But we don't use those much anymore. The newer ones on the market today, if people accidentally or intentionally take too much, it might make you feel really sick, but it wouldn't actually harm you physically in any way. And most of them are very safe to take with other medicines. Of course, you do need to check with your doctor to make sure. So as a class, they're extremely safe medications, but they can have side effects, which I talked about earlier, and those side effects can be quite annoying and for some people may not be worth the benefit they're receiving.
And as you mentioned, it's an individual process, and it sounds like you have to do a lot of tweaking before it works for some people.
There's a lot of trial and error. If you talk to anybody who's gone through treatment for depression, seeing a psychiatrist, they'll tell you, commonly, oh, I had to try three different medicines, or it took me forever to find the right dose, or whatever. So sometimes it's easy and you get it the first try, but sometimes it's very trial and error, and we're just not to that point yet where it can do a blood test or a brain scan and say, here's the dose and here's the exact medicine you need.
And for our listeners that prefer a holistic kind of treatment, what kinds of things can they try to do with their practitioner?
Well, I talk a lot about this in the book, about some proven holistic treatments. And I mention that because there's a lot out there that are not proven. And I think it's important if you're going to spend the money and maybe not get on an antidepressant and possibly delay your treatment to do something that is more proven to work. The most common is St. John's wort. Many people have heard of that. It's available in most health food stores. And there's good evidence to show that mild to moderate depression does respond to St. John's wort. Other things are things like fish oil, omega-3, fatty acid, for example, certain types of B vitamin supplements. But most of the vitamins, you have to have a low vitamin level in order for the vitamins really to do their job. So if you have a normal B vitamin level or a normal vitamin D level, taking more isn't going to really help. The main thing if you do a natural treatment is make sure you take enough of it and make sure you take a good quality. Many people sometimes go for price, or they look at the doses on the bottle and they use that. And in many of the studies, they used a lot higher dose than people realize. So it's very important to use a good quality product and make sure you take enough of it and do it under the advice of somebody who really knows the science in this area.
I guess with some of the lower quality supplements, you've got to watch for things like lead and all sorts of things you really wouldn't want.
Oh, absolutely. With fish oil, most fish oil, fortunately, does not have mercury in it, but you do have to watch out for lower quality products and make sure that you don't get things like that in there.
Well, Dr. Banoff, taking antidepressants is truly a comprehensive guide to depression and how to treat it, how to recognize it. We just really want to thank you for spending the time with us, and know people are really going to get a lot of benefit.
And have them check the website. It's takingantidepressants.com, and it has information about the book and how to order it and a lot more information about depression as well.
Terrific. That's takingantidepressants.com?
Yep.
Great. Well, thanks again, Dr. Banoff.
Yes, thank you so much for having me.
That's the end of our interview, and I hope you've enjoyed it. For more great health-related interviews, go to Michael Senoff's hardtofindseminars.com.
That's the end of our interview with Dr. Michael Banoff. I hope you have found it helpful, and for more great interviews on brain training, marketing, and advertising, go to Michael Senoff's hardtofindseminars.com.